Now, for a change of pace, let us go to the far northern hemisphere. The 28 NATO states are currently meeting in the Polish capital of Warsaw. A priority, what to do with Russia? Is President Vladimir Putin taking the country back to sort of Cold War-style defence? Remember, the conflict in eastern Ukraine is now in its third year. There are high-level discussions about Putin, but my next guest has been on the ground. He's been travelling through many of the former Soviet states. He's been talking to the locals, and he recognises a very definite mood shift, even a hankering for some of the old Soviet days. He also sensed, by the way, that the airbrush may have been taken to some parts of Soviet history. Kurt Johnson is a writer and a mathematician, and he's recorded his adventures in his first book, The Red Wake, a hybrid of travel, history and journalism. And Kurt Johnson's in the studio. Kurt, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Good morning, Andrew. How are you?
I'm very well. Now, Kurt, sometimes when I hear about Western democracies talking about the revival of the Cold War, I ask if they're really trying to revive an old enemy. But there are fears that Putin is reaching back to Russia's imperial days and that he wants to sort of re-establish Russian influence on the countries outside the immediate borders. You've been to these former Soviet satellite states. What were you seeing and hearing on this political question?
It was very interesting travelling around this area, which is an enormous area. Just talking to regular people on the street and going around and continually asking them whether they be taxi drivers or just people in these old Soviet bars. Do you think it's better now or do you think it was better back then? And the answer that I continually got 9 times out of 10 was that they thought it was better back then. And there was this, you get this enormous impression that people look back on this period with a tremendous sense of nostalgia, and that there's a feeling amongst a lot of them that their impression of what the deal they thought they were getting into at the collapse of the Soviet Union, which was everyone was going to be fabulously wealthy and they were all going to have kind of 3 cars and live in these big houses, there's this sense of a betrayal by them of what this deal of what democracy and capitalism is.
Oh, well, that was Boris Yeltsin and shock treatment. You know, yeah. If they didn't think they were all going to live in big houses, they at least thought that they'd go to supermarkets with the shelves well stocked and things like that.
Yeah, well, there's the classic joke is that during communism we all had money but there was nothing to buy, and now we have there's everything to buy but no one has any money anymore.
You speak Russian, I'm assuming, Kurt.
Yeah, it's a beautiful language but incredibly difficult for an English speaker to learn. I studied it for 3 years and after I did a six-week very intensive course in Kyrgyzstan, and I assume I'd be able to speak it spectacularly by the end of it.
So as you journeyed around the old Soviet Union, what, you were greeting people, Tavarish?
Yeah.
Which is, I think, comrade, isn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. But I first got the idea of going, this impression that things might be different and their version of history might be different over there compared to our one when I travelled to Moscow in 2006, and I was in Red Square and visited Lenin in the mausoleum, and being a little bit disappointed that he didn't look like the statues, but coming back up to the cobblestones of Red Square and seeing this procession of elderly people with the Internationale, which is the anthem of the USSR, belting out through tinny speakers, and watching this procession all marching under these red flags and realizing that their version of history, for them, the Soviet Union wasn't something done and dusted. It was something that was still alive.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about the airbrushing of history because it really exists. I was in Georgia many years ago, and I visited Georgia. It is a beautiful country. I visited the Stalin Museum. I can't remember the town, and I did ask the guide there about the forced starvations and the famines, and all she said to me was, during the Stalin period, mistakes were made. I think that was. But look, I want to ask about the places that you went and the people that you met. But how did you first become interested in the Soviet Union? Because you do have connections through your grandparents.
Yeah, well, they grew up in the in former Czechoslovakia, and they had to flee the communists after the Second World War when the Red Army kind of swept through, because my grandfather, he came from an aristocratic family, and it was not a great place to be around, you know, if you're well off. And so he fled and he came to Australia, and I always grew up with this idea of my grandparents kind of whispering about, you know, the communists, and them still speaking about it as if the room was bugged, having this this mindset. And so growing up with this constant reference to this place that I didn't really understand, and the kind of the tarnished side of the Iron Curtain, which I could never visit. And there was an interesting moment when I went for my second trip to Russia, traveling on the Trans-Siberian through Siberia, and getting a call from my mother saying that my grandfather had died. He was still in Australia, but this confluence of me visiting a very historically loaded location and this family event.
Yeah, it was at your grandfather's funeral, which was held in the Czech Republic, that you observed, I think, the townsfolk, and they were making a guard of honour for the family to walk through. And you wrote that this custom isn't a testament to the resilience of the old order, but to the disruptive power of the communist era and the spiritual vacuum that they now lived in. So were these old Soviet satellite states, the Czech Republic of your family's past, are they struggling to find new identities?
The satellite states are achieving a new identity, creating a new identity a lot more successfully than the countries of the former Soviet Union. So that's an important distinction to make, that the USSR was this the heartland of communism, and the satellite states always saw themselves as being invaded by communism, always something as a foreign. So it was a foreign ideology. So it was there. It was much easier for them to cast off this ideology and resume their former kind of identity. But even as you said, in kind of the Czechoslovakia, it was a period of kind of 40 years of these foreign invaders, and that's, you know, two generations, and it was really difficult for them to kind of restore this old identity. And there's the invasive kind of ideology still had a disruptive power. Still, there's still kind of a fracture between the past and the present.
Now, Kurt, you wanted to go to Central Asia because you wanted to see how communism had worked or hadn't worked in the Muslim world. And I think you went to those Stan countries. What did you find out there about the ethnic divisions that were left over from the Soviet era? Because Stalin basically just imposed these artificial borders. So what did you discover?
That's right. Again, there's this quest for identity. So it's very important to understand how these different countries deal with the Soviet collapse by understanding what was there before. So you traveled through these stands, and it used, before the Bolsheviks invaded, it used to be just part of the Russian Empire and kind of this large region. There was no nation states in existence there. So the Bolsheviks, they rolled in and they created these nation states with the assumption that they were creating this international socialist order that was going to come through, and the idea of nation states would kind of dissolve once they'd realized this utopia of communism. So they built it. So Stalin came in and drew these borders with the idea that it was always going to be temporary. And then you fast forward to the Soviet collapse, and these borders that were drawn in 1921 still are in existence. And they're the cause of massive ethnic conflict. So you have a situation where, say, for example, Kyrgyzstan, which has the so much mountains, they have kind of 95% of the region's water, and the rest of the countries are very, very dry. So because of these borders that were drawn by Stalin, there's one country that has a complete monopoly on water, which is a cause of massive kind of conflict there, as there's a rush to resources.
And there was all these big transfers of populations by Stalin too in the 1930s and 40s. The other area that you found most fascinating were the de facto independent nations, because they're struggling with their ethnic questions as well. Tell me about Nagorno-Karabakh.
Okay, so Nagorno-Karabakh is a little enclave which is entirely surrounded by Azerbaijan. So that's in the southern Caucasus, just to the south of Russia. And it has a majority Armenian population. And it was there in the capital, which is called Stepanakert, there was a small protest began in 1988, and that protest grew and grew. And because of the ethnic strife between these Armenians, which is a neighboring country, and them wanting control of this tiny little enclave, and the Azeris in Azerbaijan, the whole of these protests spread all throughout the Soviet Union, and all of them looked at this kind of nationalist question that was happening there. And it's always credited that this protest began the kind of the end of the Soviet Union. And even today, if you look at the news, kind of what's happening in the news last week, they're still fighting over these borders that were drawn there in 1921.
Yeah, Nagorno-Karabakh, it flares up every so often. Mm. It's Saturday Extra here on RN, Andrew West with you. I'm talking to writer and adventurer Kurt Johnson about his new book, The Red Wake, about his journey through the old Soviet Union. Don't have a lot of time left, Kurt, but I did want to talk about Transnistria, which appears, I think, on no United Nations map or it's not officially recognised. But tell us about Transnistria.
Well, that's a fascinating little sliver of land, and that's on the eastern border of Moldova. Now, Moldova's interesting because it used to be part of Romania and was invaded by the Red Army, and they're very much looking west. So they want to become part of the EU, but this tiny little sliver, you go there and you get a feeling that the Soviet Union is still alive there. So in the rest of Moldova, they speak kind of Romanian, and then you cross over to this tiny little sliver of land and everyone looks Russian. They all speak Russian. The town all has this Russian characters to them, but you still get this feeling of it being marooned, not just in time, but also in space as well.
And is it the home of the last gulag?
No. The last gulag is in Perm, so that's in Siberia.
Yeah.
But it still has kolkhozes, which are collective farms.
Yeah. You went to the last gulag, though, didn't you?
I did. So that was in Perm, near this formerly closed city, so it never appeared on any maps. And that used to be run by Memorial, which is an organization that wants to acknowledge all the terrible human cost of Stalinism. And this last gulag has since been taken over by the government, wanting to expunge any references to the human cost of Stalinism. Mm-hmm. So there's this very deliberate change in tone of wanting to change the history of the Soviet Union to something.
Well, I was going
positive.
To ask you about that, just to wind up, this deliberate airbrushing of history that we're seeing in the Soviet Union or in Russia. The last gulag, what does it look like? How have they attempted to dismantle it?
No, so they inherited it at the end of the Soviet Union, and it was all kind of smashed up, succumbing to the elements, and they rebuilt a lot of it. So you go through and you get an idea of, you know, inside these barracks, glassless windows, very, very dense kind of bunks all together. So you can feel exactly what it was like to be one of these prisoners or zeks, as they're known, to exist inside this gulag. Mm-hmm. But I haven't since returned to it, but I hear that it's changed from something to remember these prisoners to something that's used to celebrate the role of these workers instead of prisoners, and them cutting down timber in the surrounding forest and helping for the Soviet victory in the Second World
Kurt,
War.
Kurt, last question. When you speak to the locals, how much of a mentality is there of, this never happened, tough times were had or mistakes were made, but that's the extent of the confession.
It's more now about mistakes were made, but it was something that had to happen for us to defeat the Nazis. The focus is all these negative things that happened. It was for us to industrialize so we could get a point and get to the point where we saved the whole world from the Nazis.
Great that you could join us. Kurt Johnson, his first book, The Red Wake, a hybrid of The Red Wake, a hybrid of travel, history and journalism about Kurt's journeys through the old Soviet Union. Thanks for being with us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you so much.
And coming up, remembering the battles of Fromelles and Pozieres 100 years later.